From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West.
I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, the historian Jared Diamond is with us. Diamond explores why certain societies survive and why others don't. And in his latest book, he looks at how nations recover from a crisis. The U.S., he says, is in a crisis because we can't manage to find political compromise anymore. And he says you cope with a national crisis in the same way you do a personal one. We'll be right back. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio, and starting on Monday, May 27th, Radio West is taking a break. After 18 years, we're stepping back to rethink what the show does well and what it could do differently. The plan is to return with a new Radio West at the end of the summer. Until then, you can get updates from me by signing up for our newsletter. It's all at radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You know that quote, those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it? Well, there are a dozen versions of it, and they all express the idea that if you look and pay attention to history, to the stories of different people over time, you'll find lessons for the way to live now. And this is a tidy, if not overly simplistic, way of describing what the historian Jared Diamond has done in much of his work. He's looked deeply at societies and civilizations from the past to see why some thrive and why some collapse. And it's complicated, of course. There are so many factors to plug into this formula, but Diamond is really good at it. He won a Pulitzer for his book Guns, Germs, and Steel, and a lot of acclaim for Collapse. His latest puts another spin on the subject. Diamond looks at how countries at critical turning points, at moments of crisis, either worked their way out of it and how they were changed, or blew it and how they were changed. The book is called Upheaval, and today in the program, Jared Diamond is joining us to talk about it. What he does in the book is identify the factors you need to go through to make it through a crisis. He says the things that help you cope in a national crisis are similar to a personal one. So to explain the connection between the personal and the national, he begins the book with a story from his own life. He says it was his earliest memory. This was this tragic event in his hometown in Boston, and he was five.
In November 1942, a fire broke out in a crowded Boston nightclub at night, and the windows were barred. This was during the war. The front door had just a narrow exit, with the result that people jammed trying to get out, and within about half an hour, 492 people got burned, trampled, asphyxiated to death. Of course, I was not at the nightclub, but my father was a physician. Boston physicians were called in to deal with the hundreds and hundreds of dead and injured people. So I heard about it, and for me it was a secondhand trauma. It was also the origins of a field of psychotherapy called crisis therapy, not the usual slow helping people deal with long-term problems, but situations where people have a sudden crisis and within a few weeks recognizing that the way they've been operating just isn't working, for example, because a relationship has blown up or a loved one has died. They got to be helped fast because of the risk of suicide. After the Coconut Grove fire, in fact, some people did commit suicide because they knew that their spouse or child had died in a horrible way. So that was a personal crisis for the survivors of the fire. Mm-hmm. It was a personal crisis for hundreds of them, but it was also the beginning of the field of crisis therapy.
For most of those who survived or were left without loved ones, you mentioned in the book that they went through this process of reappraising their values, rebuilding their lives. And then you use this word mosaic here. You say that even in the best cases, these people remained, this is how you put it, mosaics of their new identities formed after the fire. Now, talk about that, if you would, how you use mosaics now as a metaphor to apply throughout the book.
Sure. People who have been through an individual crisis and survive the crisis and figure out a new way of dealing with that situation, even for the rest of their lives, they're going to be a mixture, a mosaic of what they were before and what they were after the crisis. So the people whose husbands or wives or children had been killed at Coconut Grove dozens of years later, they would still remember that. They would still be affected by it. And yet there would be the new themselves that had dealt with their grief, perhaps even remarried. Just as a personal example, I have a friend whose sister was killed in a horrible way about 60 years ago. It's now 60 years later. My friend still remembers and thinks of his sister. Of course, he's got 60 years of life after that, but he's a mosaic. I'm a mosaic of things that I went through early in life and what I am now, and everybody is a mosaic of their early experiences and of what they've gained after traumas.
Now, Professor, we'll dig into this in particular as we go, but explain why you see it as useful to view a national crisis through the lens of an individual one.
That's a good question. Why on earth is it useful to view a national crisis through the lens of an individual crisis when we know perfectly well that nations are not people writ large?
Yeah,
nations consist of millions of people, but nations differ from people in very basic ways. Nations have leaders. An individual doesn't have a leader. Nations have groups that compete in deciding policy. An individual does not have groups. So why is it useful to look at national crises from the perspective of personal crises? One way is I'm still teaching at UCLA, and I find that my undergraduates, of course, can relate easily to personal crises. It's more of a stretch to relate to national crises, and so talking about personal crises helps one ease into thinking about national crises. The other reason is that my wife, who's a clinical psychologist and did a specialty in helping people go through personal crises in that specialty called crisis therapy, my wife, at the end of each week with her fellow therapist, would talk about which clients were succeeding in dealing with their personal crisis and which not. And as Marie talked about it, I realized that in many cases, similar things apply to the outcomes of national crises. For example, people, if one has a trauma such as the breakup of a marriage, we all know that it helps to talk with friends, to get emotional help from friends. Well, countries don't get emotional help from other countries, but countries do get material help from their allies. And we also know that in working through a personal crisis, it helps to have models of how other people dealt with a similar crisis. If your marriage broke up, if you messed up your marriage, it helps to see how other people have successfully resolved their marriages. Similarly, countries may use or may refuse to use other countries as models for solving problems. Those are some straightforward examples of how personal crises suggest outcome predictors for national crises.
Professor, talk to us, if you would, a bit about what got you thinking about this particular book. And it's interesting, I was reading, a lot of people are wanting to know where this fits with your other work, Guns, Germs, and Steel, and Collapse. And one of the things you've said, which kind of surprised me a bit, is that you don't necessarily see a relationship or a relation between those books. They're just things that you're interested in at the time. There's not necessarily a connection in all of them. Would you just talk a little bit about that, if you would?
Sure. There is and there isn't a connection.
Yeah.
The way in which there is a connection is very broadly. My current book, Upheaval, is by the same person, Jared Diamond, as wrote Guns, Germs, Steel, Collapse.
Right.
It's also the case that my approach is similar to my approach in my previous books. I write what's called comparative history. Many or most historians write single case studies. They write books about 18th century Germany or about the history of France. I don't write single case studies. I write books comparing different countries or different societies. If you compare, then of course you can't devote the whole book to just one country. There's less you can say about any one country. But if you compare, you see questions that don't arise when you study just a single country. There's a quip among historians: he or she who studies just one country ends up understanding no country, because you can't make comparisons. So the similarity is that all of my books are by the same person, me, with the same approach. The differences are that it's not the case, as some people suspect, that my current book, Upheaval, grew out of my previous books. No, in fact, whenever I finish a book, I then explore what the next book is going to be, Usually it's unrelated to the previous book. For example, when I finished Guns, Germs, and Steel, I was thinking of writing a book about the cantatas of Johann Sebastian Bach.
Wow.
My editor convinced me that was not a good idea. And instead, something else that interested me was collapses of societies. So I went on to collapse. Similarly, when I finished my previous book, The World Until Yesterday, about tribal societies, mm-hmm. it's not that my book about tribal societies led straight on to my book about national crises. Instead, national crises have interested me ever since 1982, when Marie did her training in personal crises. It's something that's been on my mind for a long time, and I had finished other things that I've been on my mind for a long time, Guns and Steel and Collapse. Here was this other thing, national crisis, that had been on my mind for 37 years, and I was having cleaned the other stuff out of the way. I was now ready to do this.
So what was the thing? Was there something going on today that accelerated your interest in national crises? Because one of the things that people should know is that this is not a book, as you lay out early on, that explores, you know, the fleeting moment. It's not, for example, about the turmoil caused by the Trump presidency and Trump administration. It's you want something that looks at things in a longer view. But that said, can we say the current political situation which brought us Donald Trump is part of some sort of American national crisis, and that got you thinking about this in the first place, I guess?
Yes and no, and this already illustrates how often people hate interviewing me because so many of my answers are yes and no. So the no part is that I began this book in 2013, before Trump appeared on the scene, and therefore the current exacerbation of America's crisis under Trump played no role at all in the launch of this book in 2013. On the other hand, it was the case that the United States was already having some serious problems by 2013. Before Trump, the United States will continue to be having problems after Trump, after 2020, regardless of the outcome of the 2020 elections. So people often ask me, Jared, was your book stimulated by the 2016 elections? Absolutely not. It began 3 years before the elections. But it is true that what's going on now illustrates the subject of national crises that are the theme of the book.
I read a review of the book in The Guardian, and it said this was your most overtly political book. What do you make of that?
That's true. This is my most overtly political book. If you think of my other books, they're not really political. My book Collapse was about collapses of mostly past societies, often with major environmental factors. My book Guns, Germs, and Steel was about the origins of agriculture over the last 10,000 years. So that, again, is not a political book. It's correct to say that this is by far my most political book.
Help us understand what you mean by crisis, the dynamics of a crisis. You say we should be thinking about it as a moment of truth or a turning point.
Yeah. How does one define crisis? A flip answer is you know perfectly well whether you're in a crisis and you don't need to define it.
Right.
But after the crisis, you can think back and how would you define it then? You can say that a crisis is a situation in which a person or a nation recognizes that the way that they've been coping with some important issue no longer works and they've got to find a new way. And immediately that reminds one that crises are usually specific. If a person, if say your wife or your husband says that they want a divorce, that doesn't mean that all your life is messed up. It doesn't mean that you've been fired, that your children have been killed, that you have gone bankrupt. It means that you have a specific problem, a marital problem. And similarly, nations, when they have crises, the United States, with its issues today, it's not the case that the U.S. has changed its geography and now suddenly we have China and Russia as our immediate neighbors. Mm. The United States has specific problems. So crises are specific, where one has to make what's called selective change. You have to figure out to change something about yourself. What is it that needs changing? What is it the nation needs changing? And what is it that works perfectly well and that you can maintain?
And Professor, you're looking at a fairly large, long scope here, a large time scale when you're looking at an evaluating a crisis, like how it's playing out over a number of years, I guess.
That's true. On the other hand, I think most historians would say Jared Diamond is looking at a short time scale in this
right.
book. And that's true, because with one exception, all of the chapters and all of the crises deal with events in my lifetime. My book deals with Finland's winter war against the Soviet Union in the 1940s. It deals with the Chilean coup d'etat of 1973. It deals with the aftermath of the Indonesian genocide of 1965. It deals with the slow changes after World War II in Australia and Germany. So this is not going back to Roman history and the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
The only chapter, in fact, that involves things before my lifetime was what happened to Japan in the 1800s, when Japan was suddenly opened up to the outside world by the uninvited arrival of an American fleet, and the Japanese realized that they had to change fast. They had to develop strength fast. They had to acquire Western military strength and Western political institutions. And Japan did this in the 1800s. While I'm old, that was long before I was born.
Right.
And I have this chapter on Japan of the 1800s because it's such an outstanding example of selective change and of the using of models.
Say a little bit more about how selective change is so key. You say this is the key, this idea of selective change.
Yes. Let's take Japan of the... Let's take something modern. Let's take Britain today.
Yeah.
What has changed in Britain and what has not changed in Britain? Things that have changed in Britain are that Britain no longer has the world's most powerful fleet. Britain no longer has the world's biggest empire. Britain is no longer the richest country in the world. Britain is closely involved with Europe, despite all the screaming about Brexit. Mm-hmm. Britain no longer depends on the Commonwealth for its identity. Those are the things that have changed. But there are things that haven't changed about Britain at all. Britain is still an island nation. Britain is still a democracy. Britain still has a parliament. Britain still has a queen. The British people still look back proudly to the summer and fall of 1940, when Britain alone fought off Hitler's Luftwaffe. So Britain still... is the country that looks back to Shakespeare and the Magna Carta and Tennyson. So Britain illustrates selective change. There are things that are unchanged in Britain, and there are things that are greatly changed in Britain.
I wanted to come back to another personal crisis you write about before we jump into the elements of crisis that apply individually into countries. But you mention a crisis that happened to you when you were just 21, and you were really kind of on your way academically. You had thrived in school before. Your parents were academics. They were supportive. You went to Cambridge to get this PhD, but then you hit a snag, and I wanted you to talk about it because this was a really difficult experience for you. This was kind of a personal crisis for you.
You are being polite when you say that I hit a snag. I spiraled into a shock that made me question what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. I had done well in school. I was used to doing well. I had imagined that I would devote myself to science, to an academic life. But in that first year in Cambridge, at the University of Cambridge, England, my experiments were not working. For the first time in my life, I was no longer in the lead. I was, frankly, a failure as an experimenter, and I was working alongside great scientists. Mm-hmm. It made me doubt whether I wanted to go into science. It made me feel that I wasn't cut out for science, but there was something else that appealed to me. I love languages. I love foreign languages. And I thought, all right, I'll drop out of science. I'll go to Switzerland, enter translator school, become a simultaneous translator for the UN. And yes, it will mean a life where with much less security and much lower pay than if I became a scientist, but I would be doing something that I would enjoy. So I was really upset and floundering around. Fortunately, my parents came to visit me at that point. Mm-hmm. They discussed with me for about a week, they listened to me for a week
right.
as I was going back and forth. And God bless them, they they were patient. They didn't tell me what to do. And finally, my father said, well, you've been planning for a career in science for a long time. The experiments have not been working for several months, but don't you think maybe it's early to pull the plug on what had been your lifetime goal? Why don't you try for another semester? And if at the end of another semester the experiments still aren't working, you can always enter language school then. So it felt like a life preserver thrown to a drowning person. I went back to Cambridge, and in that next semester, fortunately, the experiments began working. I carried on with a career in science, but it was my most upsetting professional crisis. And it was upsetting because, again, we all know from our experience that the crises that we experience as teenagers and as young people are our most upsetting crises because they're usually our first major life crisis. Mm-hmm. After that, we have the experience that I got through a crisis. When there's another crisis, I got through something before so I can get through this one. But this was my first big crisis. That was why it was such a shock.
What was it that you saw in reading and, I guess, reading again and maybe even reading again Walden by Thoreau? Because you said you felt shaken by what you saw as the message in that book during this point.
I was shaken by reading Thoreau's Walden. And now that we're mentioning it, just 2 weeks ago, for the first time in my life, I actually went to Walden Pond in Massachusetts and saw where Thoreau had lived. In high school, I read Thoreau's Walden. And when I was going through this existential crisis in my first year of graduate school, I reread Walden. The takeaway message, at least for me from Walden, was figure out what you really want in life and do it regardless of what other people say. But be true to yourself. Don't do something just because other people approve of it and praise you for it. So here I was in my existential crisis about science. It looked to me as if scientists are pursuing science because they want to get praised and famous by other people. They want to win Nobel Prizes. They're not pursuing science just because they love science. And it's perfectly true that all scientists care about being praised by other people. The message to me of Thoreau's Walden was that science is based on a falsehood. Well, gradually I realized science is not based on a falsehood. It's based on a mixture of truth and falsehood.
Yeah.
The falsehood is wanting to get approval from other people. But I gradually realized I love science. And so ever since I came out of that existential crisis, I have never reread Thoreau's Walden, perhaps because of fear that it would shake me up again.
Jared Diamond. He's a professor of geography at UCLA, the author of a number of books, including Guns, Germs, and Steel. His latest is Upheaval, Turning Points for Nations in Crisis. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. A lot of people want to know, does Doug really read all those books? The answer, yeah, he does. No one really knows how, but we do know that he gets up very early. If you want to try keeping up with him, you can buy the book by clicking on the indie bookstores, Amazon, or Audible links at the bottom of the episode page. If you do, some of the proceeds go to support Radio West, so thanks for that, and thanks for listening. Here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the historian Jared Diamond. In his influential books like Guns, Germs, and Steel, and Collapse, Diamond explores why it is certain societies survive and why others don't. His latest looks at how nations recover from a crisis. It's called Upheaval. Well, let's go through these factors that you lay out in the book. First, as they relate to individual crises, and then how we can connect them to national crises. And the first one, I think, is critical. The first, some relate really well between individuals and countries. Some maybe not as well, but clearly, number one, the one you list first. Is relevant for individuals and countries, and that is acknowledging that there is a crisis, I guess.
Yes, if you don't, if you as an individual don't acknowledge that you're in a crisis, if your wife says, "I want a divorce," and you say, "This is no crisis. I'm a perfectly good husband." Obviously, you're going to get absolutely nowhere to fixing the cause of the divorce. And similarly for nations, if a nation refuses to acknowledge that it has serious problems. And there are many Americans, including Americans in government today, who would deny that the United States suffers from serious problems.
Yeah.
Then you're going to make no progress towards resolving the problem. So a first step is acknowledgement. And, of course, a second step is taking responsibility.
Right.
For a person, if you say, "I'm in a mess, but that's because of these bad people out there, and there's nothing that I have to change about myself," then if you don't accept responsibility and if you just let yourself be swamped in self-pity, you're not going to make any changes. Similarly, a country, if it blames other countries, is not going to make changes. Again, in the United States today, we hear so much about the bad things that China and Mexico and Canada are doing. Well, the United States has problems caused not only by China and Mexico, but also by us Americans. The only people who can end democracy in the United States are Americans. Chinese and Mexicans can't end democracy in the United States.
Yeah.
So the first two steps for people as well as for nations are acknowledge that you're in a crisis and accept responsibility. If you don't do those two things, you get nowhere.
You also mentioned the importance of using other individuals as models of how to solve problems. Say something about this part too, because this is another one of those elements that is going to require some, frankly, some self-assessment and some humility.
That's true both for people, and this one maps nicely onto nations.
Yeah.
People can get help from other people, and they can use other people as models. If one messes up one's marriage, when my first marriage failed, I talked within the next few days with friends, and I gradually learned about how friends had dealt successfully with marital problems that I had messed up. Similarly, countries can learn things from other countries. Japan in the 1800s, when it realized it would have to change fast in order to cope with the outside world, Japan sent embassies around the world to study parliaments, to study cabinet government, to study electrics, gas, street lighting, to study railroads, to study court systems, to use other countries as models. But the Japanese didn't just adopt whole scale exactly what was going on in other countries. Instead, the Japanese considered carefully the court system in Germany, France, Britain, and the United States, and figured out which court system can be modified to work best in Japan. That then is an example of successfully using models. An example of refusing to use models is, again, the United States today, where we Americans face problems such as health care, immigration, education. We Americans are very dissatisfied with our health care system and what we're doing with immigration and our educational system. But the fact is that other democracies, our neighbor Canada, and Western European countries and Japan also, of course, face problems of healthcare and immigration and education. And some of these other countries are much more satisfied with their solutions. But we Americans believe in what's called American exceptionalism,
yeah,
the belief that the United States is so exceptional, so unique, that there's nothing that we can learn from other countries. But for heaven's sakes, healthcare and education, those are universal problems. Of course, we can learn something from how Canada and Western Europe and Japan deal with those problems, but we refuse to do so, and so we are wallowing longer than necessary in frustration with dealing with these problems because we will not look to other models.
Say something about, there's another one that I wanted to mention, I think maps fairly well, too, between individuals and countries, and that is core values, having core values.
We people and also nations have core values. Most of us have core values of loyalty to family. We would not get out of a crisis by sacrificing our child. Many of us have loyalties to a religion. Many of us have loyalties to our country. We would not get out of a crisis by betraying our country or by reneging on our religion, usually. So those are core values of people. Nations also have core values. There are things that nations will not change. For example, Finland, when it was attacked by the Soviet Union in 1939, Soviet Union had a population 50 times that of Finland. This was a real crisis for Finland, an existential crisis. The Finns realized they were going to have to fight their way out of the crisis and thereafter deal with the Soviet Union. But there was one thing on which the Finns were uncompromising. They wanted to preserve their independence. They wanted not to be occupied. And so they were willing to make changes in their foreign policy towards the Soviet Union in order to be able to maintain their independence. Independence and the Finnish language and everything that goes with the Finnish language, those are core values to the Finnish people.
Let me jump forward to the sections you've written about the United States itself, because you, as you say, you go through the cases of seven different countries, and I wanted to ask you about the United States in particular. You go through it. First, you begin with the advantages, which I think is important to note. You talk about how we're the world's most powerful country. Geographically, we are, as you say, endowed with great real estate. We're virtually immune to invasion. We have good soil. We have good waterways. Politically, of course, we have a democracy that's worked pretty well for some 230 years. We have high socioeconomic mobility. It's been one of the advantages. So you go through that, and you spend some time with that. But I wanted to start focusing on some of the problems that you lay out, because I want to get to these issues and then the solutions that you see for them. And the number one issue that you see, problem for the United States, that, is, as you say, is making us squander all of those advantages, is a deterioration of political compromise. For most of our history, you say, we managed to come up with compromises, but for some reason we're not able to now. Talk about this problem first, because this is, I guess this is number one for you.
This is what I see as our most serious problem, in the sense that it's our problem that most immediately threatens American democracy. I foresee the possibility that within 5 or 10 years, if things go badly, the United States will no longer be an effective democracy. Mm-hmm. It may be a democracy on paper, but it may not be an effective democracy if our legislature and our executive cannot agree on passing legislation. The Congresses in recent years have passed fewer laws than any Congresses in recent American history. We are in something of a gridlock between legislature and executive. We are having executive intrusion upon the judiciary. Supreme Court justices are no longer a non-political office. They're instead appointed on highly political grounds. There is gridlock between some states, such as my state of California, and the federal government. And so this breakdown of political compromise, I see as the thing that threatens the United States in the most immediate future. Now, one can say about democracy, well, why are we so happy with democracy? Look at China. It's not a democracy. China can do things really fast. China got let out of gasoline in 1 year. In the United States, a democracy, there were all sorts of court cases, and it took 10 years to get let out of gasoline. So maybe it would be good if the United States became a dictatorship. And it's perfectly true that dictatorships can do things faster than democracies, because you don't have to argue and convince people. But nobody has figured out in the 5,000 years of human government and history, nobody has figured out how to ensure that dictatorships make only good decisions fast and not bad decisions fast.
Right.
China's a good example. China, yes, got the lead out of gasoline very quickly, but China also had some horrible decisions of closing down its educational system for 1 billion people, sending the teachers out into the countryside, and instituting economic policies that caused about 30 million Chinese to starve to death. Well, the United States, whatever bad things our democracy has done, we've never caused 30 million people to starve to death.
You also, this was interesting, you write in the book, this polarization is much broader than just the political sphere. I wanted you to say something about that, because this was so interesting. You talk about the decline in courtesy when we're driving our traffic, the declining friendliness on hiking trails and streets, the just increasingly abusive speech of all kinds that you're seeing.
That's right. Initially, I thought that there's this breakdown of compromise in American political life. There's this increase in nastiness. Initially, I thought this is a phenomenon confined to American political life, and it must have some purely political explanation, such as Congress people going home on the weekends with the rise in domestic air travel and not staying in Washington and seeing each other as friends. But then I realized, and friends pointed out to me, obviously, and every one of our listeners knows this, that nastiness has increased in other spheres of American in other spheres of American life. Driving nowadays is nastier than it was 40 or 50 years ago. There's more road rage now, much more road rage than in the past. In academic life, life of science and life of professors, there's more nastiness, much more nastiness than 60 years ago when I entered academic life. Or another example, here's a really homely example. Just think of what happens when you get out of an elevator and what you're supposed to do. The rule used to be, let the people in the elevator get out first before you get into the elevator.
Right.
But you know what? And 50 years ago, that was the case. You let the people out of the elevator. But nowadays, the next time you're in an elevator, just watch what happens. People are starting to push into the elevator before the people in the elevator can get out. So that's just a homely example of the breakdown of civility. And again, another example of the breakdown of civility is that we know perfectly well that there's much more abuse, much more cursing, much more name-calling in American life nowadays than there was in the past.
It's interesting. You mentioned how a lot of our entertainment today is solitary rather than social. You mentioned that there's this decline in social capital. But you also point this out, and I wanted to get you to talk a little bit more about it. One of the things you point out is that it's not like other countries don't have cell phones and digital distractions. So you ask, why is it? Why hasn't political compromise declined and social nastiness increased in other affluent countries? Why is it that, and it's not just the United States necessarily, but we do have a particular problem. What do you make of that?
That's the biggest unresolved problem. Why is nastiness more acute in the United States than in other countries? And I have two guesses, and these are just hypotheses. One hypothesis is that technology tends to develop first in the United States and spread around the world. So it may be that the internet developed in the United States, it eventually spread to Italy and Japan, and it may be then that Italy and Japan eventually will get as nasty as the United States now. We've just had more decades of the internet to encourage us to be nasty. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that there's just less social glue in the United States to bring people together than there is social glue in Italy and in Japan. There's less social glue in the United States because our country is so big, and we Americans move more often than do Italians or Japanese. So most of us Americans have moved away from our childhood friends. Relationships and friendships count less in the United States than they do in Italy and Japan. This is very much on my mind now because I'm just back from Italy, and in 2 weeks in Italy, I have more social life, more lunches and dinners than in a year in the United States. So those are my two hypotheses for why nastiness has increased in the U.S. more than in other countries.
Jared Diamond, his latest book is Upheaval, Turning Points for Nations in Crisis. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. Hi, podcast listeners. So you probably know we also make short films, and so I just wanted to get you to watch our latest. It's about a U.S. Army soldier, Alyssa Peterson. She conducted interrogations during the most intense moments of the fighting in Iraq. And in 2003, she died by suicide. The film is the story of her brother, Mitch, who wanted to learn what he could about her death. He told us he owed it to her. The film is called Casualties. Go see it at RadioWest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the historian Jared Diamond. We're talking about his latest book, Upheaval, Turning Points for Nations in Crisis. I was fascinated by this section you write on Chile that shows what happens when political compromise breaks down. In that case, you write about it led to that military dictatorship in 1973, eventually. So, and you do point out, of course, that there are differences in some things about the United States that makes it less likely than Chile to degenerate into a violent military dictatorship. But then you also say there are some differences that make the U.S. more likely. Would you say something about this, too, and the comparisons between Chile and the potential future for the United States?
Yes, you are fascinated by Chile, and so am I, and so are my students at UCLA, but you should be more than fascinated. You should be upset and worried about Chile.
Right.
What happened in Chile? Chile is the Latin American country with the longest history of democracy. I lived in Chile in 1967. My Chilean friends explained to the American visitor, namely me, we Chileans, we're not like those other Latin American countries with frequent military dictators. We are a democracy. We're more like Europe. We know how to govern ourselves. That was what they said. We know how to govern ourselves. That was 1967. But political compromise was declining in Chile in the 1960s. Polarization between the left and right, and polarization within the left, and polarization within the right. Does that remind you of anything going on in the United States today with polarization within our political parties and between our political parties? And in Chile, it blew up in 1973 in a military coup d'etat that ended democracy in Chile for 17 years. Well, in the United States, if democracy ends, if the breakdown of political compromise leads to ineffective dictatorship, it's not going to be a military coup as it was in Chile, mm-hmm. because the American military has never intervened in politics. It's going to be a different way. Democracy will end, if it ends in the United States, it will end by the things that we see going on now. It will end by local and state electoral officials making it increasingly difficult for citizens likely to vote for the other party to register to vote. It will end by gerrymandering, which means at the state level manipulating electoral districts so that the other party gets less than their share of representatives. It will end by an increasing role of huge amounts of money in swaying elections. Mm-hmm. So democracy in the United States, if it ends, will end by the things that we see going on right now and increasing. It won't end by a military coup.
Yeah.
But already American democracy is impinged upon because, for example, a gross example is the recent election for governor of the state of Georgia. The winning candidate for governor of the state of Georgia was also the chief electoral official who set the rolls for elections in the state of Georgia. Boy, if you want to take an example of impingement on democracy, that's a glaring example.
So let's talk, Professor, how then we, as you do, because this is where the book heads. It heads to how we take these problems and we plug them into your framework of crisis and change. Because some of these, we already talked about some of these, but I wanted to go through some of these again, and maybe we could start with our cultural advantages. One is our strong sense of national identity, and this is another one of those factors that seems important. How do we use our cultural advantages, our national identity, as a way forward, do you think?
That, for me, is a very current question, very current thought, because I'm just back from a couple of weeks, in fact, touring around the United States on book tour. But I began my book tour by visiting one of my two sons who lives in Boston. My son Max asked me to take him out to the battlefields of Concord and Lexington, where the American Revolution began, and I thought, okay, so I'll take them out there. I've been to Concord and Lexington. I didn't think that Concord and Lexington would do anything to me because I'm familiar with Concord and Lexington. I must say, revisiting Concord and Lexington battlefields was for me a emotional, almost shattering experience because there is where American democracy began. That's where Americans were willing to die for liberty. That was the start of the American Revolution. And it made me think, the Battle of Concord and Lexington was April 18th. Why don't we have a president who on April 18th of each year goes to Concord and Lexington battlefield and reminds Americans about what holds us together, namely liberty. Why don't we have a president who goes to Ellis Island and Ellis Island, the immigration portal for the United States, and commemorates Ellis Island, because all Americans are immigrants, even Native Americans immigrated 13,000 years ago. Why don't we have a president who goes to the Mississippi River, because I was in Minneapolis, and who commemorates the Mississippi River and the locks on the Mississippi River as a key to the larger system of inland waterways in the world. In short, why don't we have a president who celebrates things of which we Americans can be proud, celebrates the things that hold us together, instead of putting us, hetzing us to be against each other. To me, our best chance for getting out of our crisis is to focus on the things that unify us rather than on the group identities that fragment us. But that's not what our president is doing today.
But that gets us to a major point that you make toward the end of the book. You say, why doesn't a president do this? Why doesn't a president point out that? And one of the things you ask in the book is whether leaders make a difference. And you have sort of two conflicting views about all of that. There's the British historian Thomas Carlyle, who said leaders make an absolute difference. But then you had Tolstoy, who wondered if they really had all of that much influence. Where are you on that score?
Well, historians debate that. Yeah. As you mentioned, Thomas Carlyle subscribed to the view that history is the deeds of great men. He said great men because this was the 1820s, never mind great women. Whereas the majority of academic historians today, I think, incline to the view that leaders are really severely circumscribed and they don't have so much freedom of choice. Where I stand in this is that there have been some recent wonderful statistical studies by a couple of economists who've looked at all leaders of nations in the world since World War II, and all leaders who did or did not get assassinated in the last 150 years. So when you compare all leaders in this way and then do a statistical analysis, it turns out that on the average, leaders can make a difference, and they're more likely to make a difference under some circumstances than others. The more power a leader has, the more effect the leader can have. So that in a democracy, leaders have more effect in wartime when leaders have more power than in times of peace. Winston Churchill had a big effect in Britain in wartime. When Winston Churchill came back as prime minister in peacetime, he had little effect. Again, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the American presidents who were considered our strongest leaders, of the four of them, three were wartime leaders, Roosevelt, Abraham Lincoln, and George Washington. So where I come down to in all this is that leaders can make a difference. There are circumstances where a leader is more important than other circumstances. Mm-hmm. And what a leader has to do is read what is going on and be a spokesperson, but also nudge a country in directions in which it may not want to go. Prime example there is the French President de Gaulle, who in the 1960s did a brilliant job of extracting France from the Algerian War of Independence by initially telling the French, who did not want to get out of Algeria, no, we will not get out of Algeria until, and then gradually de Gaulle weakened the conditions until France got out of Algeria. That was a brilliant job of leading a country into doing something that it didn't want to do. Mm.
So I'm going through and I'm adding up our cultural advantages or our advantages as compared to the disadvantages when I look at all of these elements that you write about. There's you mentioned our strong sense of national identity. You mentioned the strong sense of American flexibility, our claimed core values. All of those are in the plus category. And then I'm looking at the other things to be a little bit more worried about, whether or not we will in fact accept responsibility, whether or not we will look to other models for, solving our problems, whether we own up, and take responsibility for all of that. So when you add all of these things up, where do you come down as to whether or not we can make our way through all of this?
Well, you've expressed it very well, so much so that I suspect that not only did you read my book, but maybe you ghost wrote some of my book. I know that you didn't ghost write it, but you've clearly thought about it. So for the United States, reasons to be hopeful for the United States are that we are powerful for geographic reasons, we have a long history, there are all those things in our favor, we have a democracy, we have a federal democracy, which is a great system of democracy. Those are in our favor. The things that are most worrisome in the United States are, at present, the non-acceptance of responsibility, the theme that we hear so often today of blaming our problems on China and Mexico. Well, our basic problems are what we are doing. We cannot change China and Mexico. The only people whose behavior we can change directly is ourselves. It's up to us to behave in such a way that we can deal more effectively with China and Mexico. But we're not getting there by denying responsibility. And then the other big concern is our refusal as Americans to look to other countries as models for how they solve problems that are tormenting us Americans today. And so my chapter in my book, Upheaval About the United States, ends with one of those things that makes readers frustrated with Jared Diamond. He says, on the one hand and on the other hand, right, there are these factors that could make us pessimistic. There are these factors that could make us optimistic. I hope that by writing my book, I will galvanize Americans to think about what are the problems in the United States so that we will make the right decisions, so that we'll have good leaders, so that our leaders will behave as leaders rather than as dividers, with the result that hopefully we will have a happy outcome rather than an unhappy outcome within the next 5 to 10 years.
There's that big fat question you ask in the book, too. You say, what is going to happen to the U.S.? And you say it depends on the choices we make. I guess that's where it comes down to, right?
Yeah, it depends on the choices. And a very simple thing that every one of our listeners can do is vote. It's incredible. Even the highest vote in recent American history was 61% for the presidential election of 2008. Yeah. And the most recent election for mayor of my city, Los Angeles, turnout was 20%. I'm just back from Dallas, Texas, where the recent turnout for mayor of Dallas was 7%. Whereas in countries like Italy, turnout for votes is always between 85 and 93%. And Indonesia, which for heaven's sakes, Indonesia did not have a history of democracy. Indonesia, when democracy returned to Indonesia, had a turnout in their first election of over 90%. We Americans, if we are dissatisfied with our government, we're getting the bad government that we deserve because we can't bother to go to the polls and vote, even those of us who succeed in overcoming partisan obstacles and registering to vote.
Jared Diamond, he's a professor of geography at UCLA. His new book is Upheaval, Turning Points for Nations in Crisis. He joined us from his home in Los Angeles. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.